Well, I want to start out with just one great big word, thanks. This has been just a marvelous week, and I just can't go into all my individual thanks, but I don't know when I've ever had more fun, I've ever felt more love than I have here this week. You've got a brand of AA and Al-Anon that just appreciate it because it is wonderful. So many good things have happened to us, but I want to share one of them with you. When we just got in our room, there was a knock on the door, and when I opened the door, there stood Catherine and Rusty with bearing gifts. They had a big basket of fruit and two framed pictures. Cliff got a beautiful picture of the chapel, but to me, mine was so special that I had to bring it with me and share it with you. Mine is a beautiful framed, the word, surely the presence of the Lord. And that is my favorite, my very favorite hymn. And when I saw it, I got goose pimples. And I want to share these words with you before I start today. Surely the presence of the Lord is in this place. I can feel his mighty power and his grace. I can hear the brush of angel wings. I see glory on each face. Surely the presence of the Lord is in this place. And that has meant so much to me. And I would like to ask your indulgence today. Would you mind if I just had them all alone up here for the next hour? But my name is Fran Bailey. And I, too, am a very grateful, recovering Al-Anon. Hi. I'm an Al-Anon. Cliff qualified me, and you heard him last night, so you know I am qualified for the Al-Anon program. But I like to say that I'm an Al-Anon by choice. I'm an Al-Anon because I'm trying to work the program. I attend meetings. I read the literature, and I am trying to work the program in my life. And the reason I'm bringing this out, I had a kind of a resentment. I heard one time at a meeting this member of AA introduce his wife, "This is my Al-Anon." And I knew she had never been to a meeting because I had tried to get her there. And that bothered me. She's not an Al-Anon. She is the wife of a member of AA. So I told my sponsor, I said, "I got a resentment I can't let go of, and I don't really want to." And she said, "Well, do something about it." So this is what I do about it. I tell every chance I get, if you are just a spouse or a close member of a family or a friend of an alcoholic, be a real, honest-to-goodness Al-Anon, because I know you'll love it. I am a grateful Al-Anon. I think that goes without speaking. I'm so grateful to AA for what they did for Cliff, how you taught Cliff a way of life and a way of sobriety. And I'm grateful for the Al-Anon program that taught me a way to live and a way of life. I will always be so grateful to it. I know that into each life some rain must fall. And you know, I'm glad mine was spiked because it gave me Al-Anon and it gave me this program and it gave me a way to live. And I'm a recovering Al-Anon. We all know that Al-Anon, that alcoholism is a family disease. I heard it said once that the alcoholic acts and the non-alcoholic reacts. And during this process, we too become ill. We adjust, readjust, and maladjust. And I went right down the line and did all three of them. So I am a recovering Al-Anon. Alcohol was not always the problem in my life. In fact, the other night the speaker was talking about his wonderful childhood and all, and I could relate to him. I was an only child. There was no drinking in our family, or maybe an occasional highball, I think they called it. But there was no drinking. I mean, I just didn't even know much about it. And I grew up in this happy family. My mother and father were very ambitious for me. My mother was a feisty little Frenchman, and my daddy was a great big old easygoing Irishman. And the combination was wonderful. Mother had all this ambition, and I could get anything I wanted out of Daddy, so I had it made. And they tried hard to find a hidden talent. I took all the lessons. I took the toe tap and ballet. I took piano. I took swimming. I took diving. And I even took elocution. Now, I went to Mrs. Fowler's elocution class, and the churches would invite the students of the class to come and, you know, do the programs at their suppers and things. Well, I didn't get to go unless there was an epidemic of chicken pox or whooping cough or something, because I wasn't real high on the talent list. And I'm standing here today thinking, wouldn't Mrs. Fowler be proud? But I did. I had a wonderful childhood, and then I went to Chicago to school. And I was thinking about this when I was kind of going over these things and thinking, boy, I went into a heaven for a young person, you know, just in college. I went to Chicago campus of Northwestern, and we had the medical, the dental, the law students, and midshipmen, 90-day wonders would come in every 3 months, a whole new thing. We were having a ball up there. But out of all these available males around there, I found this fellow from Mississippi, this good-looking dental student, and I set my sights on him. And like Cliff said, we had a lot of fun in Chicago. I mean, it was a good time. My sorority house was a half a block off of Rush Street. And if anybody here is familiar with Chicago, Rush Street is one nightclub and bar after another. And so it's not a place you take your girl for a soda or something. So we'd go to Pal Joey's, this little bar. Cliff never asked me for a date. He'd say, how about a brew? And I was like, Cliff, I didn't drink when I went to Chicago. I mean, I had never had anything to drink. And so we kind of grew up together. And by the grace of God, I'm not an alcoholic. I loved the drinking where I could sing like Doris Day and dance like Ginger Rogers. I loved it when I got to that point. But when the floor started doing this, I didn't like that. Cliff said that the reason I'm not an alcoholic is I just didn't have the persistence. When things got rough, I quit. But I know now it's but for the grace of God that I could have been an alcoholic, because I really enjoyed the partying and I enjoyed everything that went with alcohol. And we had, as he said, we had a good time in Chicago, and we did a lot of drinking. And then as we went into the Army, the same pattern emerged. But then my story really begins when we get to Grenada and we get into this life in Grenada. I loved everything about it. I loved the friends we had, and I loved our little country club and the dances and the partying. Well, when Cliff said he was going to quit drinking on the train when he put out that cigarette and put down that drink, I thought, oh, shoot. You know, he's going to mess up my apple cart. Because I didn't know he was an alcoholic. And I thought, this isn't going to be fun anymore, because nobody's going to like us if we don't drink, because everybody, you had to drink to have friends. And, of course, Mississippi was dry, and I never saw more drinking in my life than in dry Mississippi. Everybody went around with a little brown bag. But first time people came to our house after Cliff made this declaration of not drinking, they came in, and Cliff said, well, I don't drink anymore, but Fran will have one with you. And I thought, well, that's a beginning. You know, that's better. So we still, like he said, we went to the same places and we did the same things and we had the same friends. And but it wasn't quite the same, because Cliff would get this look about 10 o'clock, you know, let's go home look, because he wasn't enjoying himself. And I'd have to run to the other side of the club to stay away from him so I could stay longer. And So there wasn't a lot of companionship or a lot of fun. I was under a stress and strain the whole time. But then after he said that after a while he started drinking again, and I thought, this is good, this is great. You know, we're going to get back to where we were and we're going to have fun again. Well, he evidently crossed over that invisible line, but his drinking was different. Before, he used to be so cute and so much fun, and he could sing like Frank Sinatra, and we were a great team with Doris Day and Frank Sinatra. But when he started back again, he wasn't like that. I mean, his drinking was a different drinking. And then I began getting that 10 o'clock look, and he began running for me, so we didn't really party together a lot during those years. We were both on the opposite sides of the rainbow then. But this drinking, I knew was different, but it really didn't bother me that much because all my friends' husbands drank. And we'd get together, like on Sunday afternoon, we all go out to the club with all the little children while the husbands finished playing golf, and we'd sit around discussing all the crazy things they had done the night before. And that was just a part of it. So this didn't bother me. But then when we went to this convention and Cliff was introduced to the pill, and he tells me, he said, you talk more about the pills than you do the alcohol. But I tell him, this is my story. As I said, I could accept the pills, the alcohol, because all my friends' husbands drank, but nobody else's husband took pills. And this is where I started getting sick and I started losing it. He told you about getting the pill. I want to tell you my version of this. I always love it when he speaks first because then I can kind of straighten things out. He did exactly what he said. He got drunk. He had the hangover. He met the man. And he took him up to his room and gave him this amphetamine. Well, Cliff's he's a fine gentleman. He's sweet. He's considerate. And he took this little pill, and it made him feel so good, so he asked for one for me. Because I was back in the room crying and mad, so he came back to the room, and he was a different person than the one that had left. And he gave me my pill, and I took it. Well, after a while, we decided we liked each other again. In fact, we had gotten mad. We had had a fight. And we were going home. We weren't even going to stay for the dance that night. And I had taken this dress. This was in the days of the petticoats. And I had wadded this dress up and stuffed it in the suitcase. And ready to pack, ready to go home. Well, after we took these pills, we liked each other. And we thought, well, shoot, there's no point in going home. Let's stay and go to the dance. And I said, but I've ruined my dress. And he said, well, go buy a new one. I thought, oh boy, this is great. You know, we really got it made now. So we stayed, and I took some of those pills with them. But to me, what they did was make Niagara Falls go through my head. I mean, I didn't like the feeling. And later on, when he was taking so many, I just thought, well, one day I'm going to look at him and his head's going to explode, because I knew what one did to my head, and I just figured he was just a goner. But for the grace of God, the pills did not do for me what they did for him. And then things went from bad to worse with the pills. This is when our whole relationship, when our whole family relationship, when everything started falling apart. I tried all the heart-to-heart talks. You know, I thought I can reach him, you know, if you just see what he's doing. That didn't work. Then I went through what I like to call the Tower of Strength stage. I thought, well, if he's going to do this, I'll just have to take control of the whole situation and run the family and be the strength in the family. I became a financial manager. I learned how to borrow money. And our daughter was in college during this time and then came home with her engagement ring. And I knew I wanted to have a nice wedding for our daughter, so I went and borrowed the money for the wedding and put on the wedding. And the father of the bride was just kind of there. You know, no contact, no consulting or anything. Gloria and I did the wedding. And then, of course, we had to have this book full of pictures. Now, this is not, I mean, I know people have a lot of bad things happen to them, and my story isn't dramatic. I mean, Cliff didn't, there was no physical abuse, there was nothing. It was just the mental anguish of seeing somebody you love doing something to themselves and not being able to do anything about it. So the things I tell you may not be dramatic. I heard a girl say her husband tried to drown her in 20 feet of water, things like that. I don't have anything like that, but these little things build up. These little things are kind of like the Chinese torture, the drop of water. I've always said if I'd been an oyster, I'd have a string of pearls with the little irritations. But anyhow, this is one of those little irritations. We had the wedding pictures made, and I wasn't a very nice person to live with. I kept telling Cliff how horrible he looked, how his skin was getting kind of a yellow glow from all these pills and things he was taking. And we got the book back with the pictures of the wedding. And on the front page, there was a picture of Cliff in his white tuxedo going up the steps of the church with our daughter. This yellow pallor that I had told him about looked like a Bermuda tan. I mean, his teeth were so white and pretty, and he had the white sideburns in. It was just a great picture. And I turned the page, and there was the mother of the bride. I had bags holding up bags. This poor, pitiful pearl expression. And Cliff said, I thought I was the one that looked so bad. So I said, it's not a world-shaking thing, but it's one of those little irritations that just keep building up. But we had a lot of problems during this time. And as I said, I wasn't a very nice person. I mean, I wasn't a loving person. I detached. I became a joiner. I joined anything anybody'd asked me to. Some Al-Anon say that they like to kind of close themselves up and draw the drapes and not see people. Well, I'm a people person. So if I'd get out with people, I could kind of forget what was going on at home. I was even the chairman of the Grenada Red Cross Disaster Committee. And I felt well qualified for that job. I joined bridge clubs. I had two or three bridge clubs. I played golf every day. I just stayed busy doing things. But I was a Sarah Bernhardt, too, because I'd be out with these people with a big smile on my face. I'd get home, and that smile would go down. And Cliff said he'd come home and get the look. And he hated the look. What the look was, it was twofold. One was to let him know how I felt about him. And the other was to read the pupils. I was a great pupil reader. I could look in his eyes and just tell just about what he'd been up to that day. So the look was just a part of it, but he didn't like the look. And after I'd been in Al-Anon for several years, I'm in sales, and I went to a seminar, and they were saying that if you're trying to sell somebody something, if you just concentrate on the left eye, you know, and look in the left eye, that, you know, you really get their attention. So I came home, and I was going to try that on Cliff. But he immediately said, what are you doing? What are you looking at? So I had to explain I was practicing my sales approach. I wasn't giving him the look. But the look wasn't pleasant. We also had a dog about this time that was just a little old stray that had wandered up and the children had fed and adopted, and he was known all over town as Bud Bailey. And one night I was sitting in the den just petting Bud and sweet-talking Bud and cuddling Bud and all, and Cliff said, if you just treat me like you treat Bud. And, you know, I actually thought, well, why not? Bud's never had a drink in his life. But Bud doesn't take pills, and when I say sit, he sits. But that kind of shows you the type of person I was. I was not one that was nice to live with. And then I was trying to control. I didn't know any better. I thought, there is some way I'm going to get through to him, and I'm going to conquer this thing. One time, when I think about all these things I did, it's ridiculous. One time, he would at times admit he was in trouble and needed, you know, would kind of like to get out of it, but you kind of get in a bind there in a vicious circle. I guess the merry-go-round is kind of what we call it. And he couldn't, and so I thought, I'll help him. So I bought some graph paper, and I sat down, and I worked out this graph. And I figured out on one day he could have so many pills in the morning, he could have so many at 10, he could, you know, I worked out a schedule. And then at night it was all right to have a couple beers, you know, before supper. Then the next day I lowered the pills, and the next day, and pretty soon we weren't going to have any problem, all we'd have would be beer at night, which was okay. I bought the pills, I got all these little bottles, I filled the bottles, I gave him the pills, and I thought I had things worked out real good. I'll never forget, I went to Bridge Club one time and I forgot to give him his 2 o'clock bottle. And he called me. I had to leave Bridge Club and go carry the pills to the office. But I was really controlling the situation. Well, you wouldn't believe what happened. I found out he was just really conning me. I was extra. I mean, my little thing was extra. He had his own stash. And he was just laughing at me, buying and handing out and doing all this. Well, talk about disillusionment. When I found that out, I took all these pills, and they were different colors, pink and green and yellow. And I threw those pills in that bedroom, and it looked like Times Square on New Year's Eve. So if you're trying to manage an alcoholic, forget it. Then I went through this thing that I thought he was possessed. I mean, I really and truly thought this. And we have a lake, a reservoir and a lake at Grenada, where they have a state park with these nice little cabins. So I decided that if he would go out and stay at the lake all by himself in a cabin and take Bibles and all these good spiritual things and just get out there and meditate these demons, he could get rid of all these devils and these demons that were causing him to do these things. So he went along with me. I packed all this good food and carried them out there and got them all settled, and I went home. About 2 days later, I thought, well, I better go check and see if the demons are gone. Well, I got there and found them sitting out on a rock looking at the lake drinking a can of beer. So there went another solution. So, I mean, I really just spun my wheels and did what everybody did, trying to control this situation, thinking that there was a way. And as Cliff said, I kept taking him to the hospitals, you know, to the psychiatrist. And when we got to this last psychiatrist, and he's the only one that talked to me. You remember that now, Bobby. He's the only one that got me in and talked to me, and I didn't think I was tattling. You know, I was just kind of answering questions. He was just kind of leading me through this conversation. And when we got through, he looked at me and he said, you have just described an alcoholic. Well, it seems real stupid to say that I had never considered Cliff being an alcoholic. Yeah, I thought it was a lot of other things, you know, the demons and all these other things. But I didn't know what an alcoholic was. Ray Milland in that movie was my nearest association with an alcoholic. And so anyhow, when he called Cliff back in the office and he told Cliff, he said, and this just frightened me, he said, from what your wife says, you must be hell to live with. And I thought, oh, you shouldn't have said that, you know. That really upset me, but Cliff took it like a real man. And then that's when he recommended AA, and I laughingly think now, I was the one that ran out in the hall and dialed the number and called AA. I mean, I was going to be sure we followed through on that suggestion. And then that's when we first got acquainted with the program, we knew nothing about the program. In fact, the first talk I heard was an open meeting, and it was a man that sold liquor, a liquor salesman, was making the talk, and to me that was, I mean, there was a conflict there. I couldn't see, you know, why a liquor salesman would be making an AA talk. But something happened to me at that meeting. During this time, it was a very lonely time for me before this. And I lost my contact with the guy that I had grown up with. I had gone to a Catholic boarding school for 4 years. And I had gone to a Catholic college for a year, and I thought I had a good background. I thought I had a good religious background. But during this time, it was a very lonely time because I lost communication with the guy that I had grown up with. I thought, well, I was married in the Methodist church and not the Catholic, and I thought, you know, boy, I was excommunicated. I had done a bad, bad thing. And then I kept thinking, Cliff tried to quit drinking for 3 years, and I not only didn't help him, I encouraged him to go back. And I'm thinking that this God is saying, well, you had your chance and you blew it, and that he was mad at me. And that's the reason we were going through all this. And I never had, in all the years that I told you about where life had just gone so good for me, I never did, thank God. I accepted it as my due. My sense of values were so shallow that I just didn't give God credit for anything in my life. So then when things got bad, I couldn't turn to him because I had not been grateful. I thought I had done everything that he didn't want me to do. He was punishing me. He was angry with me. And later on, when I got into Al-Anon, this one night, my Al-Anons had a challenge. I was one of those but Al-Anons. You know, my situation is different, you know, but. And they had a real, real challenge. And one night, they were telling me, you didn't cause it. You know, alcoholism is a disease. You can't control it and you can't cure it. And I said, but it is my fault. The reason we're going through this, God is punishing me because Cliff tried to quit drinking and I didn't encourage him. And one of these Al-Anons looked at me and she said, who do you think you are? And I said, why? You know, and she said, think of all the people affected. Think of Cliff's suffering. And think of all the people affected through his alcoholism. And God would do this to all these people just to punish you. And I am ever grateful to that, Al-Anon. And I still see her, and I still, every time I see her, I give her a big hug and tell her thank you. Because she really helped me to open up that wall of communication, and I thought, well, God isn't punishing me, and now maybe he'll listen to me. But I didn't know how to pray. I mean, I didn't know what to say to him. And that first night at that meeting, I looked up in back of the speaker, and there was the Serenity Prayer. And in my memory, I don't remember ever having seen it before. I may have, but it just didn't ring a bell. And I sat there that night, and I memorized that prayer because I was afraid I might not see another copy of it. And now it's real funny. My daughter, when we moved, my daughter came to help me put the pictures and things on the wall. And she got real frustrated. She said, Mommy, you can just put so many Serenity Prayers in one room. You know, that's all I got to hang on my walls. But that night was my first introduction to the Serenity Prayer and my first introduction to anything concerning AA. The next week, we went back up there and went to go to another AA meeting, I thought. And they gave us a group closer to Mississippi. It was on that side of Memphis that was geographically closer for us. And so I went with Cliff to find out what I had to do to keep him sober, to get him sober. And when I got there, this man met us with a cup of coffee, and he said, let me take you to the Al-Anons. And I said, the Allahoos? I had never heard the word. So he took me in this room with a bunch of women, and I was furious because I wanted to stay out there to find out what to do. And they didn't even put me by a door, you know, where I could kind of listen and eavesdrop. So that was very frustrating, and I don't remember too much about that first meeting, except I remember the expression on the faces of those ladies in there. I saw something on their faces that when they'd speak of the alcoholic, they spoke with love and compassion, where I hadn't done that. You know, mine wasn't a feeling of love and compassion. So we kept going back, and as Cliff told you last night, he wasn't really getting the program too well then. He was, and the reason we were going back, because Al-Anon was helping me. I was off his back. I was concentrating on Fran, as they had told me to. And so he wanted me at those meetings. And like they told me to detach, and I did. My detachment was, okay, Buster, you do your thing and I'll do mine. It wasn't a detached with love sort of situation, but that's what I needed at the time, and that was okay. But we kept going up to Memphis to Al-Anon, and the more I went, the more this line of communication began to open. And after the Serenity Prayer, I learned to say these little simple prayers like, good morning, God. I've heard that Norman Vincent Peale says, you know, you can say either good morning or God, good morning, God, or good God, it's morning. And I had said good God, it's morning, so, you know, so often. But I learned to say that, and I learned to say thank you, God. I didn't want to get caught with my hands in my pockets again, so I was always ready to say thank you, God. And then I learned to say, thy will be done, and give me the strength to accept it. Those were my prayers. I couldn't pray these long, and I still can't. But I think just these little short prayers that you kind of throw up, arrow prayers, one of my friends calls them. But with that praying, I began to get a little more faith and a little more communication with the God that I understand. I heard a speaker one time say that faith is what we send up and grace is what God sends down. And as I began to get this faith, then good things began to happen. The Al-Anon program I was sharing with somebody a little while ago, to me, is a program of feeling. You hear these things, you go to meetings and people tell you these things and tell you, and then all of a sudden one day you feel it. And I remember during this period when they talked about let go, you know, just let go of it. You can't do anything about it. Just turn it over to God. And I was putting the laundry up, and I opened up the drawer that Cliff's socks were in. And I knew he was drinking beer, and all, but I thought he was doing better. And I thought the hiding and sneaking from me. But you know, we spouses, I'm not going to say Al-Anons, we spouses have a sixth sense. Sometimes you find things you're not even looking for and you don't want to find. Well, that's what happened to me. I opened this drawer and heard this little rattle. Reached back there and there was a little bottle of pills. Well, my first thought was, I think I'll just leave them up here so I know I found them. And my second alternative was, well, why don't I just throw him out so we won't have him? Or I could meet him at the door when he comes home, you know, and shake him in his face. But then my fourth alternative, he'd been sober for 10 years, and I was speaking in Greensboro, North Carolina, and all of a sudden this confession came out in front of God and everybody, and I thought, I don't believe I said that. But I confessed at that time that I would pull apart the capsules and dump them out and fill them up with flour. If I felt maybe particularly loving that day, I'd put powdered sugar in. But Cliff didn't know that, and I had never told anybody that I had done that. That was my own And there I found myself at the Al-Anon convention in Greensboro, North Carolina, confessing this. But that was my fourth alternative. And Cliff said I could have killed him because he was just buying more to do what they were supposed to do. But anyhow, that day I had been to Al-Anon and they had said, let go and let God. And so I thought, no. All of a sudden that let go and let God, I began to feel what they meant. I put the pills back in the drawer. I closed the drawer and I thought, this is between Cliff and his God. If he's going to take the pills, that's his business. And, you know, I had a good day that day, and if I had kept those pills or done any of those four alternatives, that would have been on my mind. It would have been a burden all day long. Where this way, I just really put them back. That's when I felt let go and let God for the first time. Now, I don't say I had it made forever after that. There are many times that I've grabbed back, you know, and taken hold. But that feeling, that you get that feeling, and it makes it easier to understand the program. In Louisiana one time after Cliff had been sober about 10 years, I made the remark that life had been so wonderful, that things had been so good, and I mean, we really, it had been just a dream since Cliff had gotten sober. Oh, well, no, one thing I got to tell you before this. When I was going to Al-Anon there, my sponsor was in, lived up near the Tennessee line, and Cliff was not doing well. He had not really gotten into the program real good. And I would call Jackie, and there was a meeting in Memphis on Monday. And one time I called and I said, Jackie, I just need a meeting. So she and this other girl met me, and we went to this morning meeting in Memphis. And after the meeting, we went out to eat lunch, and of course, Cliff was the only active alcoholic of the three of us. So we were trying to figure out, you know, we were discussing him. And I said, you know what I wish would happen? We had been to Jackson and Memphis and Jackson and all these hospitals, and the insurance had run out that would cover that because they didn't cover it as much as they do now at that time. And I said, what Cliff needs to do is have a wreck. And just one car wreck and get hurt bad enough that he'd have to go to the hospital and he couldn't go to work and he could have to get off of the pills and everything enough to absorb the program. And I don't remember putting it in the form of a prayer, but I did voice that. But anyhow, the following Thursday, Cliff had his wreck. And on Saturday, one of these girls called me and she said, Fran, I've just been thinking about you and Cliff and wonder how y'all are getting along. And I said, well, Cliff had a wreck Thursday night. And she said the hair stood straight up on her arms when I told her that. And this is something I didn't admit until just a few years ago, really. You know, when they called me from the hospital and told me that Cliff was out there and they were sewing him up and that he'd had this wreck and all, I really think my first thought was, well, God, finally listen. You know, I had prayed these prayers for years and had told God exactly how to do it and when to do it and where to do it. And he listened, and so Cliff had his wreck. And that wreck was our miracle. That was the beginning of a whole new, different life. And Cliff did, you know, go to Harbor House, as he said. So life had been so good. I mean, we had 10 years there where the whole family, it just kind of gelled together, you know. And I made the remark from a podium, and I said, you know, if anything ever happened, I just hoped that I would have the program where I could work the program like I preach it. You know, I haven't been tested, and I just hope, you know. Well, God was listening again. So he decided to try me out on that. And I had no sooner gotten home than I got a message. My mother lived in St. Petersburg, and mother had had emergency surgery and was seriously ill. and that I needed to go right on down to St. Petersburg. Well, when I got there, being an only child, mother had terminal cancer, and we just wanted to get her over the surgery to get her to Grenada so she could stay with us. And she had a little condo down there, and I had the responsibility all my own to sell it, to pack up her things, to get rid of what I thought. I mean, a lot of responsibility, wishing I'd had a brother or sister to share it with me. And that first night I was in that apartment, I was so lonely and so frightened and so overwhelmed. And so I said a little prayer, and then I thought, okay, now let's put Al-Anon to work here. Al-Anon works in all your affairs. So I got the paper out, and I found out where there was an Al-Anon meeting in St. Petersburg the next night. I went to this meeting, and they weren't going to have it because there was a cold snap down there that year, and they just had a little bitty heater. And I drove up there, like they said, 5:30. I didn't know it, but that was a newcomers meeting time, and there were no newcomers. And I sat in that parking lot for about an hour. And I was praying during this hour, please let somebody come. Please let there be a meeting. Well, pretty soon a car drove up, and there were two girls in it. And then a little while later, a car drove up with one girl. And they stood out there, and they kind of talked to each other. And I got out, and I said, are you here for an Al-Anon meeting? And they said, oh, yes, do you need a meeting? I said, I really do. Well, we went in, and one of the girls said that she was standing at the sink doing dishes, and they had agreed not to have a meeting that night because it was so cold and the heater was so bad. And she said she was doing dishes, and all of a sudden she said, you know, we've got to go to that church and have a meeting. So there was God again looking after me. I was the delegate from Mississippi for one term. And I was asked to make one of the spiritual talks. And that was the theme of my talk, God Knows My Needs. Because looking back, I see where he got there just when I needed it, not before, not after, just when I needed it. And that night, I really needed those girls for that meeting. And they just held that meeting for me that night. But a funny thing happened when I was in St. Petersburg. There was a cafeteria down the street, and rather than fix my own meals, I'd go down to this cafeteria and eat. And one night I got in line, and I was talking to this lady that was in line, and we were just chatting, and we decided to eat together. And she was asking me what I was doing in St. Petersburg, and I told her about Mother and having to sell the condo and all these things that I had been facing. And she said, oh, this must be a very lonely, hard time. And I said, well, it really was when I got here. But I said, I've just been taking things one thing at a time, doing it one day at a time, and I just turned it over to God. And she looked at me and she said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, no, I'm an Al-Anon. She said, well, you're talking our talk. I knew you had to be one or the other. I didn't realize, but I put the Al-Anon program into practice and made it through that very difficult period much easier than it would have been if it hadn't been for Al-Anon. I've been in the program now for 23 years, and I've been through different stages. You know, we don't stay the same. Hopefully, if you do, you're not doing much with your program. And I like to relate. This just came to me one day, and I was thinking about it. I like to relate my period in the Al-Anon program with a car. Okay, I was around the program for, you know, quite a while. I heard these things, and I could see these things, and all, but I was just around it. Then after a period of time, I got on the program. I got on the car. And if you notice, that's an Iowa on. That's not a Mississippi on. But I was just on the program and on the car, and it was great. But when we hit a curve, I fell off. But then when I got in the program, I got the security of the car around me. And that's the way I feel now. I've got the security of the program around me. But that doesn't mean I don't bump my head on the sides every now and then going around curves. I told you that, you know, I said nothing had happened. Life was so good. Then Mother's illness, and then Cliff had his stroke. Well, something happened when they had him go down to Jackson to do that dye test, you know, to see if there was still any blockage. And Cliff told the doctor, he said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I don't want any mood-changing drug." He said, "When you do what you're going to do." Well, the doctor didn't listen to him. And I remember walking in that room when Cliff woke up, and there was that same expression on his face. There was that same kind of talking. And I felt like somebody had kicked me in the stomach. This night, and I had to go out in the hall, and I stood in the hall, and I said, "They did this to him. They did it. He didn't. They did it." And trying to, but my Al-Anon just went out the window. That same feeling came back. So I realized that I had a lot to work on. And like Cliff said, we've had some wonderful things happen to us, but we've had problems. Everybody has problems. Life isn't going to be without these problems. But we've been able to work them out, and I like to control. You know, I'm the mouth, I'm the boss here, I'm more the controller. And it's made me a better mother-in-law, though. I think I get along great with my in-laws. My son-in-law and I just have the best relationship. He's going to leave glory for me someday, I think, because we just love each other. But and I think Al-Anon's helped me do that. There are times I don't like to see them make mistakes, and I want to help them. But I've learned, and Cliff's a good Al-Anon. He'll say, "Give them the right to make their own mistakes." So practicing that in our family life has meant so much to us in our family life. And Gloria gave me a little plaque. But before I tell you about the little plaque, I want to tell you kind of the way I am. And in case you might be sitting there thinking, "Gosh, Cliff's lucky to have her. You know, she's really gotten this thing down." He might talk to you later and straighten you out. But I'm kind of like the little boy that fell out of bed one night. And his mother heard this thud, and she ran in the bedroom, and she said, "Honey, what in the world happened?" He said, "Well, I got too close to where I got in, and I fell out." And so that's kind of the way I am with my program sometimes. I get too close to where I get in, and I fall out. But our daughter gave me a plaque one time for Mother's Day, and it said, "Mothers are all those wonderful things you never outgrow your need for." Of course, that means a lot to me with those words. But I like to paraphrase it to read, "Al-Anon is all those wonderful things I'll never outgrow my need for." And that's why I am always so thrilled and so excited when I get an invitation to stand up in front of a group of people and say, "My name is Fran Bailey, and I am a grateful recovering Al-Anon. And thank you for listening to me."